it really that hard to say sorry? Now, you cannot change history or undo the damage. But sometimes an apology can be the first step to healing. But the British, silent. No remorse, no reparations. The Empire's lies have been exposed. Now it's time to ask for justice, for truth, for accountability. He is here to demand it all.
There is absolutely no breathing. This is the lightest day I've had for years.
Oh, wow. Here I'm thinking that, oh my God, you're getting, I don't know, 500 calls. No.
Action.
His words are sharp, his facts are sharper. Dr. Shashi Tharoor, welcome again.
Thank you, Runjana. I hope my memory is still sharp. That's the other way I tell you again.
So our episode is on accountability more than just an apology text.
Yep.
We didn't get one, did we?
We didn't. And in fact, it's something that I've been demanding. I demanded it not only in my books and my speeches, but when I was in the UK, I had the opportunity to do a bit of a little tour on Inglorious Empire. And a lot of TV stations, a lot of bookshops, a lot of public events, university forums, and the British Parliament, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And in every place, I made this point that whereas reparations, which was the subject of the Oxford debate that triggered all this off for me, are not terribly feasible for all sorts of good reasons. There is the fact that any payable amount is not credible, and any credible amount is not payable. There's a professor, Ursa Patnaik, who did a very serious study that established £45 trillion as the value of the drain of resources from India in the British Raj. Somebody else has come up with a figure of £69 trillion. So you're talking about money which no country can possibly pay. So reparations are talked about, but I think are essentially theoretical. But one thing which is not talked about enough is moral atonement. And what do I mean by that? I mean three, four things. First, teach unvarnished colonial history in your schools. When I published my book, I was shocked to discover that it's entirely possible to do an A-levels in history, the highest school leaving certificate in the UK, A-levels, without learning a line about colonial history. Not one word. That's wrong. Second, London is full of museums. Some of them are what we in India would affectionately call chor bazaars, thieves' markets, full of goods purloined from other countries. Is there a museum to colonialism? No. The only museum, even with the word imperial in it, is the Imperial War Museum that celebrates British military victories during the Raj. How about a museum that shows the experience of colonialism even for the subject peoples? They finally got around to creating a museum on slavery in Liverpool. Let's have a museum on colonialism in London, the city that most benefited from it. Third, some memorials. There is even a memorial in London to the animals that served the Allied cause in the two world wars. Can you imagine? To the animals, there isn't one to the Indian soldiers who gave their lives to keep that country safe. And finally, and perhaps most simply, how about a simple apology? I remember saying at the time, the best opportunity is coming up in 2019. It'll be the centenary of the Jallianwala Bagh massacre. It's going to happen on the 13th of April. Use that day and apologize. And then when I was in a more mischievous mood, I would say, look, if no British politician has the courage to issue an apology because they're afraid it'll cost them votes, get somebody from the royal family to do it, because after all, everything was done in the name of the crown. The point is, that message was given loud and clear. to the extent that the then British High Commissioner took me aside and said, Shashi, you've got to understand something. I get what you're saying, but it's not going to happen. Because if we apologize to you, we'll have to apologize to 130 countries. So I said, smilingly, I said, not really true. I said, if a place like Singapore was a barren rock before you built it up into the prosperous metropolis it became, that was not true of India. India was a thriving country that you essentially destroyed. An apology is due here. An apology isn't due to Singapore or Hong Kong. So we laughed, parted. That was that. A few months later, he called me and said, you will be surprised to know that your demand is making headway. I said, what happened? He said, there is a note moving that is going to the cabinet proposing that we should indeed take your request seriously. So I waited. And then before the 13th of April 2019, he said, be prepared, the Prime Minister is going to speak in the House of Commons. I remember Parliament was in session in India at that time. I was waiting with bated breath. The media were also tipped off. They were also waiting. And Theresa May, the then Prime Minister, issued a statement of regret. We regret the events of that day. Now, what is regret? You know, I can regret an earthquake in Iran. Is it the same thing as saying, I'm sorry I caused it? So I'm sorry to say we never got the apology.
Well, when we talk about colonial accountability, we cannot not talk about the Jallianwala Bagh massacre. You just mentioned it. Now, over the years, like you said, we've heard words like regret, distress, deep shame. But these diplomatic terms really feel like salt or old wounds. Do you think that dodging accountability really is a part of imperial tradition?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, on Jallianwala Bagh, it is startling to go back to the newspaper clippings of that era and to see not just the denial, but the blatant justifications, the lies, the claims that there were actually armed rebels in the crowd. There wasn't a single. It was Baisakhi. People had gathered together. At most, they were going to hear speeches against the Ralut Act, which was the rather oppressive colonial legislation that had just been passed. But it was an occasion for families. There were women and children there. They were not there as armed rebels. It was a blatant massacre of innocent civilians. And it was perpetrated as a simple example of colonial evil at its worst. And all the stuff that accompanied it. Do you know, for example, that after the massacre, they shut the gates and would not let the families in even to tend to their dying loved ones. Wow. You can imagine there were women at the gate hearing their husbands crying out in pain and listening to them die. It's unbelievable that human beings could be like this. Do you know the day after that, this evil Reginald Dyer, the general, ordered Indians to crawl on a street on their bellies, and he had soldiers standing with lathis and rifle butts to hit anybody who raised his head while he was crawling. In denial of it, to have actually justified it at the time, to have rewarded General Dyer with a purse collected by the readers of the Daily Telegraph and presented along with a bejeweled sword as an act of heroism, to have people saying that he saved the British Empire. This is the kind of utter outrageous kind of stuff that took place in the aftermath of Jallianwala Bagh. 100 years is not long enough to have to pay for this evil.
Now, there are a lot of countries that have asked the British Museum to return the stolen artifacts. Indians on the internet want that too. Where do you stand on that debate?
Well, I certainly stand in favor because for some time now, I've been making this point that restitution is not just moral, it is also a legal fact. For example, in the Second World War, a lot of goods, particularly belonging to Jewish people in Europe, were looted by the Nazis, the Germans. So the Jews were often fairly prosperous. They had valuable art, statuary, paintings, and so on. And at the end of the war, wherever these could be identified, they were returned, either to the original owners, or the original owners had perished in the war or in the concentration camps, then to their descendants or their families. And this process has continued even till recent years, because descendants are now coming up and claiming, this was my uncle's thing and it's now sitting in the home of this German family, whatever I want to bet. And by and large, not only have the families concerned said, we didn't know we got it that way, you can have it back, but courts have also upheld the right to restitution. Now, if you can do that in that case, why would you not do it for these items taken from India? Now, I'll tell you where the argument comes. In some cases, it comes from the fact that history, that it's all so long ago that it's very difficult to challenge ownership. Something has been in my family for 100 years. Yes, it was stolen by my great-grandfather, but what the hell? I've had it. My father had it. Now I want to sell it. Who are you to stop me? And there, I mean, I haven't gone, I'm not a lawyer, I've not gone into the legal details, but this may be a more difficult case to win in a court. I learned, for example, quite recently, that an item that was stolen from Tipu Sultan by one of the officers in the siege of Seringapatnam 1790 on has surfaced in a long-term descendant. There must be a great-great-great-grandson who has found this in an attic or whatever, and it's valued by Sotheby's at some, you know, £100,000 or whatever. And he wants to sell it and make the money. Why shouldn't he? Now, the question is, does India say this was ours, it was stolen from our territory? I don't know. I mean, I'm not even actually aware if India has laid that claim, but I don't know how the courts would settle a thing like this. Whereas with the Jews, the theft is relatively recent. It's been a different story. Then there are the items that are of collective possession. For example, the Amravati stupa was dismantled and taken away to the UK. This is a beautiful stupa. It's 2,000 years old. Right. Now, it belongs to whom? Ideally to the place, Amravati, which is now in Andhra Pradesh, where this Buddhist stupa stood. To that degree, you can say it's public property. Ideally, these pieces should be brought back and reconstructed, restored to the stupa. The British say, but this is old ancient history. We dug it up, God knows, a couple of hundred years ago. We took it off to England. Now it's there. It's in a museum. Why would it be any better off to bring it back to Amravati? These are debates that, unfortunately, are still going on when it comes to colonial artifacts. My answer is, where does something belong? If you've taken an idol from a temple and you parked it in a museum, an idol that used to be worshipped in that temple for centuries before, does it not belong to the descendants of those who worshipped it there? To my mind, the answer is clear. The answer is yes.
The British education often treats colonialism like a footnote. Is it just bad history, or are we looking at a full-on, like how you say, historical amnesia?
Look, I think it's both. I think it's partially bad history. It's partially deliberate denial. No one likes to be told that in their family tree there are a lot of skeletons, right? I mean, there's this joke about the person who discovered his grandfather was electrocuted at Sing Sing prison for murder and armed robbery or something. And he said, oh, my grandfather occupied the chair of applied electricity at one of the nation's leading institutions. I mean, no one wants to admit, right, that if somebody in their family treated something bad. And the British are no different. But the problem with this is that so much of who they are today is a result of colonial exploitation. How can you read Jane Austen's decorous novels of social life in England without even being aware of the fact that that life was being sustained by money made from sugar plantations and the sweat, backbreaking labor of black Caribbean workers who had been enslaved in Africa and taken to do this? But there is no consciousness of that. This is English literature. That is something else, somebody else's problem. Now, nobody's perfect. I'm sure all of us have convenient gaps in our historical memory. But at least if we can point it out, they should be aware of it. Do you know, for example, that when slavery was abolished, something the British are rightly proud of, that they were the first country to officially abolish slavery, do you know that who was compensated? Much compensation was paid. Not to the slaves or their families, the victims of the process, but to the families of the slave owners for the money they had lost when their slaves were free.
It's ridiculous.
That's true. That's the history. That's the way this world is or has been.
There's a documentary on Netflix. It's called Churchill at War. Have you seen it?
I've heard about it. I have no particular desire to see it because I'm not...
Well, I don't think you like it either. It barely has a word on Churchill's role in the Bengal famine, for example. Even his war room in London skips it. Is this British pop culture where we're still whitewashing empire?
Yeah, and whitewashing is a word. There was a film that was made about Churchill at War, not the Netflix documentary, a feature film, which won some Oscars and so on. And it has completely fictionalized scenes of Churchill getting on a train and talking to a black immigrant. The man was a notorious racist. He would certainly not have talked to any black person as an equal. as a servant, perhaps, but that's it. This is not a decent human being by any stretch of the imagination. He's hailed by the British as a paragon of democracy, democracy that he sought to deny people who are brown and black around the world, including us. And the kind of character who, when he left India, where he served as a young subaltern, left unpaid bills, and that unpaid bill is still framed in the Bangalore club where he was a member. This is not a particularly admirable human being, but for the British, he was the hero, the great Lionheart, bestriding the ramparts of English civilization with his really powerful speeches on radio during the war. Well, great. I mean, you know, if you feel that these speeches matter more than the lives, decent self-respect of black and brown people, welcome to you. But the Great Bengal Famine was largely caused and perpetuated by him. It was something which he had many opportunities to stop and resolve. There were officials, conscience-stricken British officials in Bengal, writing to him, saying there are people dying on the streets before our eyes. Would you please mind diverting some of these grain ships from Australia so that we can actually unload the grain here? And he wrote saying, oh, the starvation of anyway underfed Bengalis matters much less than that of sturdy Greeks, because the grain was being shipped to Greece for a future possible invasion of Greece. It was meant to shore up the buffer stocks. That was the kind of... So grain for potential future use rather than to save lives of people dying today. And when the British said that there's so many deaths happening and that it was on their conscience, Churchill wrote on the margin of the file, why hasn't Gandhi died yet? That's this man, Churchill at war. I have no desire whatsoever to dignify this whitewashing, as you rightly call it, of this odious individual.
Now, when Impaland came out, author Satnam Sangira, he faced a lot of hate, both offline and online, just for talking about empire. Why do you think it triggers people so much when brown voices speak about colonialism?
No, I think in his case, he's an Indian Brit. That is, he lives in England, writes in England.
But brown.
Brown-skinned. But what I mean is that he is part of that society, and it's the resistance within some elements of the same society to one of their own, quote-unquote, reminding them of some of these features. I think that's the difference. I read Empire Live when it came out. In fact, he and I were supposed to do some events together for whatever scheduling reasons I was not able to. But I think it's a very fine book. And at the same time, this business of reminding people of uncomfortable truths is always a challenge. Now, that way, the Germans are quite exemplary in their willingness. I mean, it took them a long time. It took them a full generation, because I remember going to graduate school with a German student who told me that his father was in the SS during the war, but never mentioned the war, never while this young man was growing up. No longer young, neither of us is young, but he grew up without any conversation about World War II. And there's a man born in the early 50s, you know, so you're talking about somebody who, for whom it was a very recent experience, but absolutely not a word about it. I remember with my wife and I visiting Germany in 1980, and we saw an old poster saying, welcome to Dachau and its beautiful Schloss. Schloss is a castle. And we thought, oh yes, this is amazing. Let's go find out if we can see the concentration camp. And it wasn't on any tourist map or any tourist brochure at that time. And we went there, we had to ask, and they said, the concentration camp is available to view. We don't advertise it particularly. If you want to go, you'll be allowed in. There's no problem. We went and we were practically the only people visiting at that time. And we got a complete tour. And we said, but don't people come? Isn't it on the tourist maps? They all looked very uncomfortable. Just a few years later, the Germans completely changed their approach. They decided that it was time to confront their past, and they started busing school children to concentration camps like Dachau to show them this is what happened. This was what was done in our name. We should never let it happen again. Now, that first generation lived in amnesia. The next few generations have grown up with a very strong consciousness that wrongs were done by our ancestors. We should never allow our society to do that again. Britain, on the other hand, if you look at the end of World War II and the end of colonialism roughly the same time, Britain has been living in permanent amnesia. They have never allowed themselves to confront the horrors of their past until very recently, when my book and others have started forcing them to confront some of these uncomfortable truths.
Reddit user calls the Commonwealth a support group run by the abuser. Hot Sashi.
The Commonwealth is an interesting institution. We talked about it briefly in another episode. I have to say the Commonwealth is... I don't know whether the wealth was ever in common, by the way. The bulk of the wealth was sitting in London. But what was in common certainly was the colonial experience and the English language. And whereas Nehruji in 1949 requested the British to allow India as a republic, we were about to become a republic in January of 1950, to stay on in the Commonwealth as a self-governing republic within the Commonwealth, with the monarch as a symbolic head of it, he did so very partially because of the strategic benefits of having a connection to the white Western world through this institution. It wasn't a bad idea. However, over the years, the importance of the Commonwealth and the British connection began to decline, partially with the decline of Britain, partially when Britain entered the European Union and the European Common Market. At that point, the Commonwealth ceased to be a priority for Britain and therefore was not particularly useful anymore for its members.
Mm-hmm. Now, Shashi, in the course of the show, we've used everything from memes to reels to reclaim history. Do you think our show really can be a textbook of sorts for the Brits?
Not just for the Brits. Yeah, the Brits actually could use some of this as a wake-up call, that maybe they'd be offended by the rather blunt language I've used in talking to you, and so they might not enjoy it so much. But I think even for the rest of the world, I was a bit surprised when I made that Oxford speech and discovered how many in India had not learned or did not remember or did not know some of the things I said that I thought were basic sort of, you know, colonialism 101, as the Americans would say. And so there is not just amnesia on the part of the British, the colonizers, but there is some forgetfulness or ignorance on the part of the rest of us too. And I would therefore argue that what you have done is a service to all, to people in countries that were colonized, to remind them of what their ancestors went through, to people in countries that were never colonized, to learn about the history of other parts of the world, to know what they escaped, and then to the country that did the colonizing, to realize how they were. I'm not saying by any means that the British were the worst of the lot. I've not studied all the atrocities of all the other colonizers. I'm told that the Belgians in the Congo performed atrocities that would make the British all look like Mother Teresa. So I don't know what the stories of other countries are, but maybe it might encourage others to tell their stories too.
To sum it up, Sashi, and like you've said, that let us forgive but not forget. And in the age where moving on is often mistaken as healing, some would say, what does meaningful remembrance look like, both for the colonizer and the colonized?
Number of things to be said. First of all, you know, I often find myself saying to young people, why am I talking to you about this subject? Because if you don't know where you've come from, how will you appreciate where you're going? I want everyone in my country, all the young people around me, to be focused on the future. I don't want them to be bogged down in the past. But they need to know somewhere at the back of their minds where they've come from, because that is what is going to motivate and impel them as they stride confidently forward into the future. And I think that's one reason, that's one kind of memory that's important even for today's young people, which is why I say forgive. I don't want them going around with a chip on their shoulder. I don't want them insulting every Brit they meet. I don't want them being rude. We should now be above all of that. It's over. It's the past. But we should know it, right? Just as in any family, you want to know a little bit about your parents, your grandparents, where they came from, what the history was, what they experienced. Have some feeling, because it's part of your legacy. You emerge from their experiences and struggles. In the same way, as a citizen of India, be aware of what India has come through and how India became the country it is today. That's the first thing. Secondly, you know, there's this old joke about somebody who asks a farmer for directions. How do I get to Delhi from here? And the farmer says to him, if I were going to Delhi, I wouldn't start from here. Now, that's part of our problem today. How do we get to a better future in the 21st century? We probably wouldn't want it to have started from where we are. We have started from where we are because we can't help it. The British left us in this condition in 1947. If they left us with a 16% literacy rate, with a 90% poverty rate, 90% of the Indian population was living below the poverty line when the British left, They left us with a 27-year life expectancy. That is, a person born in India, the average Indian, could not expect to live beyond the age of 27 in 1947. They left us with the world's highest rates of maternal mortality, infant mortality, of disease, of all sorts of problems. That's where we came from. That's where we start from. Yes, I wouldn't have started from there, but I need to know that that's where I had to start from. So when you look at where we have reached, and you have every reason to complain, after all, we have been free for 77 years. If people see you have no one to blame but yourselves, that's partly true. We have taken decisions, good ones and bad ones, in the course of these 77 years. But where did we start from? That is what we have to remember also. So remembrance, memory, I don't want to go through life with a chip on my shoulder, and I don't have one. Today, if I meet the British, it is on behalf of a sovereign country, a sovereign equal. By the way, the economy of exactly the same size today, we're slightly larger, in fact, in overall GDP in dollar terms. We are a country that can look the British in the eye, and we should have the maturity to say that the past belongs in the past and we will focus on today and tomorrow. But having said all of that, I'm reminded of a story of, which may be apocryphal because there's no proof for it, but I heard it from some individuals. One heard it from his father, who in turn had been a friend of Jawaharlal Nehru's, that apparently Churchill, when he was receiving Nehru in the mid-50s in London, said to him, I'm surprised that you don't hate us. I'm surprised that you are able to be so civil with us after all that we've done to you. And Nehru is supposed to have said, I was taught by a great man, Mahatma Gandhi, never to fear and never to hate. I think those are very valuable lessons for all of us today. Let us not be afraid either of the past, the present, or the future. But let us not also hate because hate demolishes us. Let us acknowledge, face the truth, tell the truth, unvarnished though it may be. But let us go on with the confidence that whatever the past has given us, we will rise above it.
Dr. Shashi Tharoor, thank you very much for all of your insights, but also thank you for letting the world not forget.
Thank you, Aruja.
The empire walked away. No apology, no reparations, only silence. But healing demands truth and accountability. Until then, this chapter remains open. A call not just to remember, but to assert.